is John. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm sober today by the grace of God. And I can repeat that, sober today by the grace of God, in the wonderful program, Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm an alcoholic and an addict, so that means I'm biceptual, right? So I work both sides of that street. I started out on my journey, my true journey of recovery, on the program on the other side of the street. And it didn't work out so well for me because, you know, I didn't really like the drama. When you have a meeting and afterwards, you know, the meeting after the meeting sometimes was like two dudes fighting over a girl in the parking lot. You know, that wasn't my part of my recovery. So I earned my seat here. I earned it through a lot of hard work, a lot of effort, spiraling down the staircase of life. I went way past what other people would call a bottom. I grew up in the little town of Santa Clara. I moved there with my parents when I was a year and a half old. My parents were, you know, I was born in 61. So my parents were children of the 60s, right? My folks were young when they had me, 20, 21. So, you know, all that partying back in those days was, you talked about it last night. It was going on, right? So on a camping trip, I was about 5 years old, and my father asked me, "Johnny, can you go to the ice chest and get me a beer?" And so I would go to get him the beer, and I looked at the little top on it, right? And I took my little finger, because I had watched how he did it, and I tried to pull it open, and all I could do is get it to go psh. But during that first summer, I learned how to pull it out of there, right? Because that was back when the beer top, the tab pulled out of the can. And I learned how to do that. And on that first summer, on getting one of those beers from my father, he said, "Go ahead and take a sip." So I took a sip. I didn't know that I really liked the taste of it, but I was sitting there by the campfire with my dad and his friends, and I was just one of the guys, right? So as time went on, and it was acceptable to open that beer, so then I would start opening it on the way to delivering it. Then I would start drinking it on the way to delivering it. And one time, I was probably 7 maybe, he thought it was pretty funny when I handed him the empty can. So, you know, as a little boy, you know, you felt your belly kind of get all bubbly and all right. And I don't know if I was competent enough to understand that it was going to make me feel different, right? Between my 6th and 7th grade year in school, there was a teen club dance. And I was the youngest boy in the neighborhood. So we were at the liquor store tapping shoulders, and I can't even believe some dude bought beer for us 4 little kids, but they did. And that was my first experience with Old English 800, right? So now, here I am, 6th grade, Old English 800, right? And one guy wasn't going to have any, so that left 2 each for 3 of us, right? I thought 2, no big deal, right? So I drank those 2 beers, and on that night I found out that I was capable of talking to girls. I actually was capable of dancing, right? I'd never been to a dance before, but I ended up on the stage in the school auditorium in a dance contest as the last 2 couples up there. My first time going to a dance and first time hammered, right? So after that event was over, I found out also what that beer would do to you. You drink a couple of tall lagers or malt liquors or whatever, and you shake it all up. Afterwards, I was puking, right? But I found out that that alcohol on that day could not just change the way I feel, but it could change the way I felt about myself. It let me come out of my shell to where I could approach people, because I was just this little shy kid, right? And so I found out on that day that things would change with the use of a little bit of alcohol. As I continued on my path, you know, it's not like a thing that would happen very often, but as I got to be about 16 or 17, I got my first job. Like I said, I was the youngest boy in the neighborhood, and we all worked at the same place. And so after work, you know, the older guys, they'd go get a couple of 12-packs, and we'd sit two doors down from my house on the bricks out front of the house, and, you know, five or six of us would drink these two 12-packs before we actually went home. And that got to be a daily occurrence. Did I think at that time that I was hooked on alcohol? No, it was just great hanging out, partying with the boys, right? You know, I started smoking weed at a young age. I was probably 11. I was looking around in my dad's closet, and I came across this little bag. I was like, wow, what's this? Smells funny. So I better pull a little bit out of that bag, right? And I went and asked the neighbor boys, hey, what's this? They're like, oh, great, right? Yeah, so they got a little pipe. We were smoking some weed. And so like I said, I was the youngest boy in the neighborhood. I was easily steered by peer pressure at first. And then it became a regular part of myself, right? Playing football, high school, smoking weed before we went to the games. You know, drinking after the games, doing a whole lot of different things, right? This was in my high school times. So by the time I had my 21st birthday, and my folks wanted me to have this great 21st birthday, right? So my mom and my dad got me a keg, right? We had a keg at my apartment. And then my mom went to the bakery and had this special cake made for me. You know the cake, the one with the boobs and all. Yeah, I had one of those cakes, right? And so what better than a boob cake and a keg of beer, right, for your 21st birthday? So, but on that night, I didn't realize at the time, and now, that was the beginning. Furthermore, that was when the alcohol was going like almost full time, but that was the beginning of something much different. On that night, after consuming major amounts of booze, one of the people at the party said, hey, I got this, why don't you try a little of this, right? And on that night, I tried a little crank, right? One of the things that I found out instantly, right, is that even though I was hammered beforehand, I wasn't no more, right? That woke me up out of a stupor, and I realized at that moment that it would allow me to drink more, it would allow me to have more fun, and it also would allow me to not have to go to bed, right? I stayed up all night long. Boy, was that morning miserable. But either way, so that was the beginning of that. You know, alcohol stayed a part of my story all the way till the end. But the other drugs that came along with it came and went. At one point there, I got a little control over and got controlled by cocaine. Rocking cocaine, making my own crack, smoking my own friggin' rocks that I made, that whole thing, right? I was able to overcome that. One, because I knew I just couldn't carry on. And two, I ran out of money, right? It was pretty friggin' expensive, right? I just couldn't do it, right? And so as time went on, crank got more powerful and it kind of turned to meth. And And so in my drinking and using times, as it started to escalate through the years, I was also racing like BMX bicycles, right? And one night, I was on this BMX bicycle. I would want to say like the month of November, 10 o'clock at night, riding down the sidewalk on Homestead Road on the opposite side of the street, going like 35 miles an hour, jumping up and down curbs and doing all that when a cop saw me. Very quickly hung a U-turn, got way ahead of me and hung another U-turn. And when I got to him, he was standing on the sidewalk. They need you to get off that bike. What appears to be the problem? He goes, well, we're about to find out. He sat me down on the curb. Got his little flashlight, you know, when they wave it in your eyes kind of thing. I don't know if anybody here has ever been through any of that, but I have. So he knew I was high. He's like, I got to get some other officers here. I said, I am not going to fight you in any way. He goes, that's not what I'm going to bring him here for. So all of a sudden, three more cars pulled up. Here I am, a guy, sitting there, November, like the month of November, 10 o'clock at night, no shirt, sweating my ass off, on a 20-inch bicycle, and I'm in my early 30s. What stands out about that? Everything, right? Everything. So the cops start pulling up, and in my mind, I'm thinking about some confrontation that was going to happen. And in turn, it was like the new stream of rookies that were on the force. And he's like, you know, they could tell you all along in the books about, you know, when you tell if somebody's loaded, when you do the pupillometer test on them. But we're going to show you how it works right now. I was their damn display case. Yeah, he showed it how it worked, and threw my bike in the back of the car and took me to jail. And so that was my first time going down for under the influence, right? And they only kept me for a few hours, and they let me out. So my thought was I needed to get back to the police station and get that bike out of there, right? Because it was worth a lot of money. So I got the bike out, and then two nights later, almost nearly the same scenario. I'm on that bike. I'm going into Central Park in Santa Clara, which is like three blocks from the house. And while I'm heading into that park, I see a cop off in the distance, and he hangs a U-turn and goes the other way and makes a right going down the street that borders the park. And then as I ride into the park, I'm like, wait a minute, there's another cop over there, another cop over there. I come around a corner, I'm like, holy shit, they've got this park sealed off for me. So I went and sat at a bench, and the same cop that I saw two nights beforehand rolls up in his car. He's like, hey, John, how's it going? I'm like, I'm okay, how about you? He gets the flashlight out, looks at my eyes. He says, again, huh? I said, no, no, no. I said, I'm still high from 2 days ago. He didn't believe me, and he took me in again. So the important thing about all of that is that when we're drunk or we're high, people notice. And sometimes the last person to notice what we look like is us. Now that I've had a significant amount of time clean and sober, man, if the police department was to hire me, I could walk through a friggin' town square and say, get him, get him, get him, get him. Because they're all loaded. I know what it looks like. So, the end of the influences started turning into possessions. And all along, my keyhole drug was alcohol. Because when I drank, I used. When I drank, I used. So even when I didn't feel like using, if I drank, I ended up using. Because it would soften my willpower. It would soften my ability for my mind to say no. It became a problem. There was a young lady who some people like and others do not like that had a really good concert show that made $1.5 billion. And during her show, with all the songs, because my wife went to this show, there was one song that the words stuck out to me, where she says, "It's me, hi, I'm the problem, it's me. It's not me, it's not you, it's not my wife, it's not my parents, it's not the cops. It was me." As soon as I understood that, there was the ability, if I had the tools, to do something about it. You see, as I said, my disease took me to the bottoms. Oh, my word. It took me to the places that some of you have read about. You see them on the news. Walk in the halls of San Quentin State Prison. Soledad State Prison. Susanville State Prison. All for small and simple little possessions that were fueled by my use of alcohol. One time when I was 35 years old, I was at Soledad State Prison, and I was getting checked into R&R, and the sergeant called me out of my little holding cell. He said, "Bartol, get in my office." See, I can break my own anonymity here at this meeting, because I choose to, because I'm proud of who I am today. And I am not fearful of anybody in this room, any room, or anywhere knowing my last name. So when he called me by my name and said, "What are you doing here in my prison?" He goes, "I'm looking at this stupid charge you're here for. And if you would have had the money to hire an attorney, you wouldn't have been here. But now you're mine." You know, during all these trips and on these vacations, you see, I'm on a cool little vacation right now. But there was a bunch of vacations that I didn't get to control the destiny. I didn't get to pick where I went. You know, I was wearing, because of the shackles and chains of my disease, I actually got to wear the shackles and chains of the California Department of Corrections. And they took me on some bus rides. Oh, my word. You ride with them fools, you riding. You know, little display. Imagine your ankles are shackled together and you've got about 4 inches of total movement, so you walk like this, right? That's your hands shackled to your waist. You have about 4, 5, 6 inches. You can barely get your fingers to touch each other. And the bus ride is so long. You're on that bus for hours. They have to feed you. So they throw a little peanut butter sandwich in your lap and say, "Here's your lunch." And it was like 2 pieces of bread with like 1.5 inches thick of peanut butter in the middle. And so here you are trying to get a bite of it while your hands are shackled to your waist and you figure out a way, but you make it happen. And then you have nothing to help you swallow it. So during one of those bus rides, I was in tears. And I told myself, "Man, look where this disease has gotten you. Look where it's taken you now." I was on my way to Susanville State Prison, an 8-hour bus ride. And I said, "You just got to stop. Enough. Enough. Enough." But was it enough? I could do recovery when I was in jail. I could do recovery when I was behind the walls of a prison. I can do recovery after I pass through the 20-foot tall steel walls in West Block in San Quentin State Prison. I could do that because I was inside. But what happens when you get released? June 17th, 2003. I was released from the Susanville Work Furlough Program, stepped down release from Susanville State Prison, doing 4 years with half-time friggin' a sentence. I got out. I checked in with my parole officer. That parole officer handed me a stack of paperwork, and the first thing I see is you are Prop 36 eligible. And I'm like, that's cool, dude, but right now, don't you know I'm clean? I won't be needing that. June 17th, 2003. June 27th, 2003, I was calling my parole officer begging for help. I spent 3 or 4 days loaded the night before. So on the about 2 o'clock in the morning on the 27th of June in 2003, something happened to me, and it was the most graphic thing I may have ever seen in my life. While making an escape, you know, I had that bottle of vodka, a bottle of lime juice, because I used to like to mix the little kamikazes, and then I had a bottle of peach schnapps on my counter in my bedroom. And I had a meth pipe and a bag of dope in my hand. I was making an escape from my bedroom to the bathroom at my parents' house. 10 feet. And as I left that bedroom door, I walked by, and there it was, a full-length mirror. At that moment, God chose to show me what I looked like through his eyes. Call it being extremely loaded. Call it whatever you want. That is my God moment. And at that moment, I saw what I looked like to everybody else but myself. I understand what everybody else had been seeing for all those years. I looked at myself, looking back at me, and I lost it. I was on the ground, dropped the dope and everything else, and hey, have a nice day, sheriffs. So I dropped it all, and I was on the floor, just crying. I had fluids and snot coming out of all my orifices and everything. I was beaten. And at that moment, my brother at the time, who was in recovery, was in the living room, and he just watched it all unfold. And he sat there. And after, I don't know how much time I was down on the ground, but I was done. I was devastated. I was lost. He came in and he said, "Hey, bro, looks like you're finally done." Pushed the pipe and the dope away. I said, "I can't do this no more." So on that following morning, because it was already, you know, past two, so on the 27th of June in 2003, I called my parole officer, and he asked me to come into the office. I'd been in that office a bunch of times. I'd been in that room that he escorted me to a bunch of times. And the length of time he left me sitting there, I was thinking again I was wearing handcuffs out of there. Happened several times. But he walked in, had a stack of paperwork, threw it on the table, said, "I want you to sign away your violation of parole." I said, "Wait a minute. I'm here asking you for a program, man. I need help." He said, "Oh, that's this stack of paperwork. You sign that one, and I'm going to give you this one." So I signed away my violation. They put me in Prop 36. June 30th, 2003, I started my Prop 36 program, and from the 27th to the 30th, I gave myself that 3 days to clean up, because June 30th, 2003 is my sobriety birthday, right? I have not had to go back. have not had to use. That moment when God let me see myself through his eyes and my own eyes was the moment. I haven't had to be on the fence. I haven't had to have my sobriety in question. I haven't had to feel like I was going to go out. At that moment, I was done. Abso-friggin-lutely done. So what do you do from there? So I did this little Prop 36 program, right? And this guy was coming and going from my neighborhood. And I knew one of the dudes at the house he was at was loaded, right? So I felt, you know, since I had like 30 days clean, it was my job to go check this dude, right? You know, don't you know? I had to go check this dude, find out who he was. So we start talking. We go in the house, we sit down on the couch, and he was telling me how he heard about me and some of the struggles I've had. And I said that I'm just working hard, wanting to try and stay clean. And he said, I can help you with that. I'm all, you can what? I said, I'm over here trying to find out why you bring dope to the neighbor, right? You mean you can help me with that? He's all, as a matter of fact, I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have 6 years clean. And I was like, whoa. If this dude, the way he acts, can have 6 years clean, I'm going to follow this guy around because I think he's full. Right? So I did. I followed him. He took me to some meetings, introduced me to a bunch of people that I now call my friends. Started going to a place called the Sunrisers Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is my home group. I have celebrated, you know, my phone will tell me that I've got 21 years plus a whole bunch of days and months and hours and, you know, minutes and everything else, right? And so I like to look at that stuff to remember what it was like, right? So at that time, when I started out with this program, I had a real empty slate. My life was blank. I had a little job, so I would go to work, and then I would plot. See, because I always thought, why do these guys get to drive a cool car, and how come they're dating or married to an amazing woman, or you know, why am I still 40 years old living at my parents' house, right? So I started to do some work. And started to go to a lot of meetings. There was a man that talked. I kept running into him. I kept being at places where he was chairing. I didn't have a really active sponsor in my life. I told people I did. But the reality was, there was a dude that was helping me that I had contacted a couple of times. They told me he couldn't help me anymore because he got a couple of DUIs. And I said, well, you can still help me, right? And he's like, well, I'm not really working a program. So I was looking, and it was right in front of me the whole time. You see, when you've been in and out of the jails and institutions, county jails and state prisons and all that, they teach you to be a certain way. If you're white, they want you to hang out with the whites. If you're black, you got to hang out with the blacks. You cannot intermingle with people. When it came to saving my life, there was a man that was talking to me. He was a black man. I needed to grow the balls to talk to him. To ask him if he would be willing to help save me from me. And when I approached him on that day, he said, you know, I've been wondering when you were going to get here. He says, give me your address. So I gave him my address, and he gave me a call, and he came by the house. You know, I was sitting out back, and I was at the table in my chair, and got my smoke, and I'm, you know, I'm doing my cool thing, and My mom in the kitchen cooking some dinner, and she's like, "Hey, honey, you got somebody here to see you." And my sponsor comes walking through. He introduces himself to my mom and my dad very politely. Walks through the kitchen, stands on the back step, just looks down at me. He says, "That is not who you are, but I'm going to help you find him." Here's this piece of paper: "Be at my house on Wednesday and every Wednesday after that." He turned around, walked out the door. My mom came to the back step, and she's like, "Honey, if I were you, I'd mind what he has to say. I think he'll whoop your ass." And he's considerably older than me, but he's ex-military, like a colonel, and he already knows about my type of BS, so what's the point in even trying? So on our first time through the 12 steps, you see, because the way this program has to work, you know, the meetings are great. A great place to socialize to like-minded folks. Real rubber hits the road when you do the work with a sponsor. And so I went through the 12 steps. I had a year clean, and I said, "Hey, Steve, they say about a year, right? Y'all know what I'm talking about. Hey, I think it's time that maybe I can friggin' maybe go after one of these girls here." And he's like, "You know something, dude? You are like way too messed up." He goes, "I think what you need to do is work on you." He goes, we're gonna loop through. We're doing the steps again because, like I was telling you all along, more will be revealed." And I said, "But what about?" He goes, "Okay, I think what you should do is plan on keeping something alive for a year." I said, "Well, I got a cat." He's all, "That don't count. A cat will keep itself alive, right? It doesn't need your participation. It will eat whatever." So he goes, "Try a plant." Well, I sucked at plants, and I would kind of give him my progress, and he just always told me, "Keep trying. Just keep trying." In my second year of recovery, there was a woman in my neighborhood that, you see, they were hanging out at my house a lot. Because my niece, she decided, because she claimed it was a hormone imbalance or something like that, to rob 5 banks. And so she was pregnant. And so she had the baby, and my neighbors would come down to help take care of the baby, because it was 3 men and a baby. My brother, my nephew, and myself. So Joy and Whitney would come down, and Whitney would help change diapers and do all that kind of thing, right? And my past experiences with women, I was guarded and sheltered, and I had the block sign up. I didn't trust you. I didn't want anything what you had, because you could, with this beautiful smile on your face, rip a heart out, step on it, and hand it back to somebody, right? But no. This girl, I just really enjoyed just hanging out with her. We literally just hang out. And even though I could feel myself probably really falling for her, I didn't want to mess up what was a lifetime friendship. You see, this girl and I knew each other since we were like in first grade. We lived 2 blocks from each other. And so we were together, and we'd gone for a ride on my motorcycle, and it was on the second ride on my motorcycle that she asked me, "Do you like going to the movies?" And I really wasn't too much about movies or whatever, but if it was going to be with her, I'd be like, "Hell yeah." All right? So So we went to the movies, and December 17th, in 2005, two people really found closeness together. And I'll never be the same after that. You know, there's times when I felt like I loved somebody, or I loved my disease, or I blah, 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 right? My innocence and heart and mind were captivated by this woman. At that point, I had 2 years clean, right? And so we started hanging out a lot more. And really, like, fell in love hardcore together, right? And my guard came down. And, you know, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I had all that macho bullshit, that I knew how to be a man and everything else, right? But I learned from her what it was really like to treat a woman and how to be a man when it comes to treating a woman. April 14th, 2007 was our wedding day. We've been married 17 and a half years. And that's my beautiful wife right there with the shoulders loose right there. Put your hand up, honey. That's my girl. Yeah, and so it brings tears to my eyes, as you can clearly see, to think about what life is now like. You know, as I was talking, I got to go on a bunch of vacations that were planned and pre-planned by the state of California. But now I get to go on vacation. This girl right here, when you wonderful people of Oakhurst invited me to come up here, and I want to thank the committee, right? I want to thank my friend Joey that got me, what is her name again? It got me connected to Sheila, and Sheila, yeah, got me connected to members of the committee, and Dave, right? And your people contacted me, you know, back in like June. And I was so excited. And all I knew is that I needed. So it was a chain of events that made this all happen, right? Because everything happens in God's world for a reason. Now, I got to speak at a fundraiser at the Ben Lomond Fellowship back in April. And apparently I made sense to somebody because he called me and asked about talking to Sheila. And then Sheila talked to people here, and then they called me. And the thing that I was kind of worried about is because I've been off of work since January. You know, my company was going to lay me off, and I got them to make it a disability thing because I have my right knee has been bone on bone for over 10 years, right? And so I knew I was going to be set for a surgery, and I was hoping it wasn't going to be before Ben Lomond. But then it was after that, and then I just hoped that I would be recovered enough to be here. You know, I didn't plan my life to be this old. I discussed the way I lived my life. I did not, like, think about retirement. I wasn't supposed to make it to 40 the way I was living. 50 wasn't a given, and 60, hell no. But being that I got together with somebody who's absolutely amazing, and it seems like when the time comes, we are going to have a decent retirement. So is there any newcomers here at all? There was only one last night. Okay, so, you know, just because we get clean and sober doesn't mean we get the opportunity for our life to be floating along like we're on a pink cloud. You know, life shows up. And when I did my steps the first time, with my sponsor. I said, why are we doing it again so quickly? He said, like I told you, more will be revealed. But also, there's a reason for it. Because as you get used to using the tools of the program, you build up a spiritual conditioning and a strength inside to deal with life on life's terms. As I mentioned, April 14th, 2007 was my wedding day. My mom was like an hour and a half or 2 hours late for our wedding, honey. Yeah. My wife was sitting in a limo crying, thinking my mom didn't want us to get married. But my mom was going through some health troubles. And she'd been in and out of the hospital. 58 days after our wedding, she got released from the hospital. And on that day, like every other day, I always went to my mom's house every day because I was a mommy's boy. Loved my mommy. And sitting there talking with her. And I look over and she's crying. And I said, what's wrong, Mama? And she said, well, she goes, I gave birth to a little boy. So the longest time you struggled. It took a long time for you to finally become the man I knew you would be. She let me know how proud she was of me with 3+ years of sobriety, right? I was almost in my 4th year. She cried on my shoulder and told me how much she loved me. Some of us don't get that opportunity. And I look at that as a blessing. That was the 58th day after my wedding day. That night, she got out of the hospital that day too. That night she calls me at home, says, you and Joy are coming over for dinner. I said, Mama, you just got out of the hospital. She said, shut up, be here at 7. Well, what are you going to do? I was there, right? So we went to dinner at Mom's house. Then the call came. Fire trucks were at their house again the following day. At 11:30 the following, or 11:15 the following day, I got a phone call from my neighbor. He said, the fire trucks and ambulances are at your parents' house. I said, I'll be right there. So I put my tools away. I'm a mechanic and semiconductor. And I put my tools away, closed up my toolbox, went into the office, told them I had to leave. And when I got there, they wouldn't let me in the house. On the 59th day after my wedding day, my mom died. She was my best friend. And, you know, I look at, she struggled so much with COPD and heart conditions and all this kind of thing. It was a way of God freeing her, right? It was a way for God to also, and I know if this is the wrong way to think about this, but it was an also another way for God to open the door for my new best friend. Because my mind was still consumed with Mama. And so this young lady, she's been there through me, with me through the toughest times of my life. June 13th, 2007, my mom died. September 23rd, 2012, my dad died. May 26, 2016, my brother succumbed to the disease of alcohol and drugs. My brother died. We were a family of four. When all those three life-changing events happened, because of this program, because of the people I know here and the ones I do not quite know yet. It's what we do together that gives us incredible strength. And I was able to make it through. I did not have to pick up. I did not feel like picking up, right? I kept my heart open and became at service for my family. You know, I look back at my time in recovery, and I'm so grateful for my beautiful wife because she gave me a purpose. Right? You can sit back and say, you know, I'm in service to God, and yes, I am, by being able to do what we do. I'm also in service to a woman who took a chance on me, that when I met her brother, said, I like you, but I'm worried about you because you're an addict, and I don't want you to get my sister involved. When we went to Black Angus, and I believe it was on her birthday, a family had the whole family there, and they took her brothers all outside, and I whipped open that ring case, and they said, all right, guys, I got you all right here. I'm going to ask your sister to marry me. What do you say? Give it to me now. They didn't have a damn thing to say. They said, dude, just make her happy. And I've been spending the last 17 plus years of my life trying to do everything I can to keep that smile on her face. So, you know, I look back at recovery and I think about where we're going with it, right? What a blessing it is to be here. What a blessing it is to be asked to come here. See, and so many people that I do not know, that I walked through the door and you made me feel at home. You see, as the saying goes, right, when you circle up at the end of the meeting and you look around at the people that are circled up with you, and the reality of that truth is that we can do together things we would never be able to do alone. And that is one of the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so what my life's like today. So, happily married. You know, the bank lets me drive a really bitchin' truck because I'm responsible enough to pay for it. It's registered. And let me show you something that'll really blow you away. License, right? Right? I have had this driver's license and I get friggin' insurance discounts for a good driving record. Right? The bank has entrusted in me to give me this destructive power called credit. And, you know, before, you know, it was 170 miles here, 300 something plus whatever it is that we do while we're here, right? I wanted an oil change on my vehicle, and during the safety inspection, they found out that I needed right front brake pads. Well, I have an extended warranty in my vehicle, and I want it done at the dealership, right? And so I was blessed to be able to tell them, go ahead and fix it, right? And this was on Thursday morning, it went in. And my girl, really cool chick service writer. I mean, she is so blunt to the point. She's awesome. She calls me up and she's like, hey, dude, it's 220. You need brakes. And I said, can you get it done today? She said, I think so. Let me call somebody. She calls me back and I said, do it. And she said, all right, about 4:30, pick it up. And so the truck got done. I got to come here because I sure as hell wouldn't have wanted to drive my wife's car out here. She's got one of them damn Camaro SS things, right? And the roads are kind of rough, so I would rather be in a truck. So the reality is I get to do things that I never thought possible. I get to go on trips that aren't sanctioned by anybody else. I get to come here, right? This is kind of a vacation. I get to meet a bunch of great people. Yeah, and I told Audra I wouldn't forget her name, right? Yeah, and so I've got to meet a bunch of really cool people. This is an awesome place. I used to come here with the Survivors Motorcycle Club for the Bass Lake friggin' run, right? I used to come here as a member of the Pathfinders, right? And then I decided that motorcycle clubbing and my recovery didn't really go together, right? It just didn't. I needed to do family in recovery, not motorcycles recovery, family recovery. I just needed to simplify it. So I left the club, and now I do family stuff. And I get to pick and choose what I get to do today. You know, my life is good. My life is great. Man, we do some clean and sober camping trips that will blow you away. You know, 6-7 RVs, 7-8 boats, and, you know, all that stuff, right? Because as you get clean and sober, you know, you end up, I came here with nothing. I wanted shit, you know what I mean? I wanted some stuff. And now every time the notice from DMV comes, I hate this stuff, right? It's like, dude, do these registration notices ever stop? And my wife would be looking at me like, dude, if you quit buying shit, maybe they would, right? So, you know, I think I was signed up for an hour. We're getting kind of close to the end. You know, I heard this thing once. So this guy walks into the back of a room, an AA room, and he comes in and he walks in and he says, hey, I've got the cure to alcoholism. Take one of these pills. The guy in the back of the room says, hey, what happens if we take two? Something else I wanted to share with you. I saw something this morning. I'm kind of like being aware of stuff, right? So I saw this shared this morning. You do not decide your future. You decide your habits. And your habits decide your future. I was like, whoa, that kind of fits. Because had I have not had my habits would have never gotten me to recovery. Recovery would have never let me find my true inner self. Had I have not found that true inner self, I would have never had the confidence to approach my wife. I would have never had that wife. And my life wouldn't be the same. So do I look back and say, you know, yeah, I went a long way to get here. A long way and a really windy friggin' road that took me to all kinds of crazy places. But had I have not done that path, I would not have gotten here. Right, so is 50 minutes okay? Or you need 10 more because I can fill it up. Fill it up, all right. So so as I was saying, right, you know, we go on these clean and sober camping trips, and, you know, people in the campground have got to be wondering. Those people over there got to be partying big time, right? They're making so much noise, having so much friggin' fun. But yet, you won't find a beer in our campsite, right? You won't find a beer in our campsite. And you see, you know, one of the things also that I'm super grateful for is that my wife's not in recovery. Because I don't know, because I'm still like a crazy dude, right? You know, I imagine if I was with a girl in recovery, I'd be wanting to inventory my crazy ass all the time, right? Because I'm one of those people that's capable of saying the wrong thing at the right moment or the right thing to the right person at the wrong moment, right? You know, like some people get really irritated by somebody riding their bumper in a car, right? That irritates me. But I get more irritated with somebody riding my heel with a shopping cart in the store. You know, and I'll let them know. So today's going to be a long day, you know, with the sobriety countdown and everything. And you know, for all you people that have been in service for this great event and making meals and helping support it, and the people running around with the host badges and all that, and the people that are working on the committee and help arrange everything that happens here for the betterment of all of our recovery, what a blessing. And I want to thank you so much for allowing me to be of service to you, right? And so I don't have much more to say. My throat's getting sore, but no, not COVID sore, right? We're not getting that, right? No, it's just dry. So, you know, when I got here, I had heard that miracles happen in these rooms. And I go to a recovery meeting with people with a long friggin' time. So when I started out this journey, as I was telling you, with my neighbor, he had 6 years and I had a month. So now, on my recovery milestone, right, because I'm not giving myself a front, but I can see it pretty easily. My recovery is strong. And as I look through to June 30th, 2025, that dude that I was trying to prove he didn't have 6 years, between him and myself, we'll be sitting at a table with 50 combined years between the two of us, right? And that's a long friggin' time. Long time. So, miracles happen here. Miracles happen for me here. And I just want you to know, we can do together, like I said, things we'd never be able to do alone. So, I implore of you, please do not leave. Do not consider checking out. Do not consider a hiatus. Do not consider any of those things as far as your strength of recovery goes. Please do not leave 1 minute before the miracle that happened for me can also happen to you. Thank you.